Other than bad habits, quitting is considered a bad thing. Vince Lombardi himself said, "Quitters never win and winners never quit." From early childhood, we're taught to keep at it. Persistence pays off. Persevere in the face of adversity. Keep on going to the end. But what if that isn't the whole story? What if quitting could actually help you achieve your goals in life? That's what we're going to talk about this hour with Alan Bernstein, psychotherapist and co-author with Peg Streep of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. Alan Bernstein, welcome to the Joy Cardine program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
So, I mean, we're told from childhood on with stories like The Little Engine That Could or aphorisms like the one that my mother used to share that she got from her mother when she used to tell me, can't, never did anything. Try, did it all. Quitting is bad. Once you start something, you're not supposed to put your hand to the plow and look back. You know, all that. It's part of our culture. Your take on this is, well, maybe not.
Well, our take is that there is what we call the myth of persistence, meaning that persistence is always the way forward. And what Peg and I argue in the book is that actually the people who are most free in life to make decisions are people who put persistence right up there with the possibility of quitting. And that gives you a freedom in life that the idea of only going forward keeps you locked in. Now, it's a very hard thing to do, by the way, to imagine quitting because, as you say, there are so many cultural myths about quitters never win and winners never quit. But what we find is that in order to actually quit, it's a more complicated process than the idea of slamming the door and saying, that's it, I've had it. It actually has you disengage from your goal first. In other words, you have to effectively make a decision about the goal you've been following. Is it really the one that you want to do? And you have to free your mind so you can then move forward. And it involves, because our society is so oriented towards quitting as being a bad thing, it involves creating a new goal for yourself. In other words, if you merely quit without the idea of how you're going to go forward, the chances are you're going to spend quite a bit of time in a kind of bad place we call rumination. Therefore, you have to have some new goal that you're moving towards, and you have to have a sense that this new goal is really a superior one for you. And then you have to really orient yourself towards the new goal by changing your behaviors.
So what goals are we talking about here? Are we talking about specifically careers, achievements?
Well, actually, both. I mean, it exists both on the personal level as well as the career level. We tend to think at this point in our lives because career has been so much in the news, we're a little more oriented towards the idea of, how is our career going? But it's equally true of relationships. In other words, if you're in a relationship where you're in a state of conflicting goals, it can be very detrimental to your not only your mental health, but your physical health. I had a case a few years ago of a couple where their spending style was so different. He wanted to spend as much as he made, and she wanted to orient themselves towards retirement, that it was in conflict with the fact that she also wanted to have a partner for the rest of her life. And, she had deteriorated to the point where her physical health was involved. I mean, she was literally making herself sick because she was caught between these two goals.
I think maybe part of this is terminology. I mean, quitter, yeah. Being called a quitter, yeah. is kind of a deadly insult. You
right.
Quitter.
It's a loaded word. I mean, dictionary defines it as someone who quits prematurely or a loser.
Right. But I mean,
that's merely a dictionary.
But I guess the analogy I would make is if you're in a maze and you
right.
come to a dead end, you aren't going to get anywhere by beating against whatever the wall is in front of you. You've got to turn around and go back and find another path. That's not quitting. That's just being intelligent.
Well, what we also do, I mean, it's absolutely true, John, but what we also do is go through some of the unconscious influences. It's not merely the conscious idea you're going to be a loser. We go through the various unconscious support systems for persisting. For example, one of them is what we call the availability heuristic. In other words, you tend to go in the direction of things that you know. And the things that you know are things that you've heard around you in society all day. For example, one example of that would be if I asked you, would you be more likely to be killed by a piece of falling airplane shrapnel or a shark? The chances are, well, actually, let me ask you, which do you think you'd be more likely to be killed by?
Boy, I think the airplane shrapnel, because I don't go anywhere near the ocean because I don't like sharks.
Well, you're absolutely right. Most people say sharks because that's what they hear about in the newspaper. Every time there's a shark attack, there's a huge newspaper story about it. But you're 30 times more likely to be killed by falling airplane debris.
Well, that's it. I'm never going outside again. Forget it.
Okay, but we're talking about intermittent reinforcement. In other words, where you're at work and occasionally you get the kind of approval that you need. There's been a lot of research on that. You may remember Dr. Skinner's work at Harvard in the 50s. He had three rats, and one rat was pushing a lever and getting a pellet every time he did. Of course, this is a very happy rat. And there was a second rat who pushed a lever, and he never got a pellet. So this rat kind of gave up very quickly and didn't go near the lever again. But the third rat, which is the one that many of us identify with, would push the pellet, and occasionally he'd push the lever, rather, and occasionally he'd get a pellet. This rat was the one who stayed by the lever night and day, never knowing when the food would come and when it wouldn't. And that's very appropriate to people who stay in positions where they occasionally get nourished or fed or approved of in the way that they need, but not often enough that it creates a career that's satisfying for them.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead.
We also have another fallacy that people get stuck with, and we see it in everyday life, but it's especially strong in our career, which is what we call the sunk cost fallacy. In other words, I put so much money into this already, isn't it a bad time to leave since I'm already so committed to it? We get that in careers where people have either put many years into their education or many years into bringing themselves up into a position of responsibility. But it also comes, I mean, you probably have seen it yourself. I mean, we just had, my wife and I have an older Honda, and we brought it to the dealer, and he said there's $2,000 worth of work to be done. The question is whether it's just sinking money into a losing proposition or whether we're doing the work that will finally bring it up to, being restored. So people, these are all unconscious ideas that work against people leaving. You put them together, this intermittent reinforcement with the rats, the availability heuristic where you're doing something that you know and like, the sunk cost fallacy where you can't be sure whether this is going to be the last money you're sinking into something and if that's going to run well. These are all working unconsciously against making a decision to quit. And to say nothing of the cultural onus of taking on the turmoil of a new path. I don't know whether you've ever quit anything, John, but I myself, early in my career, I was in graduate school to become an academic, and actually had taught for a couple of years, and I was in the middle of my dissertation. This is true of Peg as well. We were in exactly the same career, and I realized that I was never going to be a researcher or professor of the kind that that was needed. I had to kind of swallow my pride and make a decision that I really wanted to go back to school and be a psychotherapist. This was painful. You know, I was a father. I had a young child. And, I was looking at another few years of academic poverty. But in that situation, I was so confident of what I wanted that I was able to do it. But I was in my 20s then. Imagine if you're in your 30s or 40s and you're making those kind of decisions with a spouse or with a job. And we have all these cultural negatives lined up against it, how hard it is for people to make the decision to quit. So we have great respect for the negatives lined up against quitting.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Alan Bernstein, psychotherapist and co-author with Peg Streep of the book Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. Well, those of you listening to this broadcast this morning, do you feel like you're in a rut at your job or in a relationship but don't know how to take that first step out or in another direction? What has stopped you from calling it quits in the past, and what are your fears about quitting? Have you ever quit something? Did you find it to be the right thing to do, or was it a mistake? How did things turn out? Give us a call, and let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You can also leave your question or comment on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine program. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Quitting gets a bad rap in our culture. It's not something you want to be seen as doing. Being called a quitter is almost the same thing as being called a loser. But maybe we're not thinking about it in the right way. The Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work is a new book by Alan Bernstein, psychotherapist, and Peg Streep, the co-author. We're talking with Alan Bernstein about quitting, doing it the right way this morning. You know, I wonder, Alan Bernstein, if, you know, one of the things that trips us up, and we alluded to this earlier, is just the terminology. Maybe instead of quitting, we should be talking about disengaging. You see a behavior that's not working. It's a healthy thing to stop doing that. It's not working, and do something that works.
Well, that would be wonderful if people could allow themselves to think in terms of disengaging. And we do use that term in the book, but unfortunately, the association for most people is quitting. So we have to work with associations that people have to that terminology. And you know, we take people through the premise that there is going to be a sense of shame that they may have to go through and admit that they have lost something. I mean, that is unfortunately part of the process of acknowledging the quit. Now, what we do recommend at the same time that you're quitting is that you begin the process of re-engaging with a new goal. In other words, to just quit without an idea of where you're going is painful for many people, emotionally and sometimes even physically overwhelming. So that, you know, we start from the premise that we have to balance the scales going forward. In other words, once you do disengage, where are you going? And we've observed four different levels of what we call disengagement. And the first one is what they call a cognitive or thinking level. So in other words, in order to leave one thought, you have to become absorbed in another thought. You have to have a place that you're going to, not just a place that you're leaving. And that's really the most powerful part of re-engagement. You also then have to emotionally or what we call affectively disengage. And that also goes through a number of stages because you'll find, first of all, when you try to disengage from a goal, you're likely first to try and, you know, work that much harder to see if it'll actually work. If I put that much more energy into it, will I be able to be successful? And it's only after that stage of reinvigorating your efforts that you can go through the sense of the other stages of loss, which is a sense of aggression. I mean, you know, why did it happen? The why me feeling and the blame feeling. And then there's always an element of sadness about it. You have made a mistake, and you have to acknowledge it. People who try to step over that and sort of push them through are skipping an important phase. There is a sadness about this, and until you feel that, it's hard to go into the full recovery. Now, this doesn't mean that each stage is discrete or separate. It means that it's likely you'll feel each of them. The first one, the attempt to redo it with more energy. And then the second one of feeling a kind of blaming and angry sense, and then the sadness, and finally the new goals really become the direction that you're going to go to.
Mm-hmm.
The third element that we've isolated is called what we call motivational disengagement, where you start to reject the goals that were unattainable in the place that you were. In other words, you start to rethink what you're trying to do. What were those goals? And in a situation like that, we try to help you separate what we call intrinsic versus extrinsic goals. And this is a very important differentiation. You know, our society, as you know, I mean, this is no news to you, John, has many, many extrinsic measures of success, money, career title, where you live. And these are important, but not necessarily the same as intrinsic goals. In other words, the goals that make you feel that you are you, that you are meeting some inner imperative, some inner sense that you are doing what, you know, you are meant to do in this world. And for many people, that may be the first time in their lives that they've really spent the time to isolate that. And one of the places that we've observed a way to formulate that, and it's not easy to formulate, is a book called Flow by Dr. Chechen Mihai. It's a Polish name, but it's a wonderful book because it helps you. He takes you through the stages of recognizing when you're in a state of flow, and he defines that as a time when you are doing something and you lose all track of time. And in losing all track of time, what you're actually doing is meeting your interests, doing it in the style in which you like to work, which can be very unique to you, and meeting your motivational needs. And if you can define those and then compare how close they are to the work you're currently doing, the chances are that if you find that there's a, you know, important difference, that you can then begin looking at that as part of your motivational re-engagement.
Mm-hmm.
I was really meant to be a community leader. I didn't realize that.
Let's try and get in a phone call. We've got some people who want to join us, and they have stories to tell that I think will illustrate some of the things you're talking about. Let's go to Susan in Phelps. Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to share that I did work as a prosecuting attorney for 17 years in the state of Wisconsin and realized that the skills and the talents and the good work that I had done could be put to use in a way that made me feel more complete, more whole, and it called to my heart. Mm. So I left my work and I became an AmeriCorps member and built houses with Habitat for Humanity. And that truly is the best work that I have done in my life.
So
I knew I was exactly where I was supposed to be.
Susan, let me ask you: what was the reaction when you told people you were leaving this job that some would look at as a really great career? You were leaving this to go do something else. What was the response you got?
People were worried for me. They thought I wasn't making a good decision. You know, and it all depends on how you define success. You're going to lose your salary. You won't have your health benefits. Are you sure you want to make this choice at this point in your life? I was in my mid-40s. So, yes, folks were concerned, but I knew that it was what I was supposed to be doing, and I'm glad I did it. It was the right thing to do.
Alan Bernstein?
Well, this is, Susan, you couldn't give me a better example of finding what was your intrinsic motivation versus your extrinsic. I mean, obviously, you were successful from an extrinsic point of view. You had a great title, and I'm sure, you know, all the benefits that you outlined, but it wasn't meeting something that was intrinsically important to you. And when it's as powerful as it sounds like this was for you, you just know that's the direction you have to go in. And then the motivational issues become the most prominent. and everything else falls by the wayside. It's a great story, and I'm glad it was so successful for you. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, Susan, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Plenty of room for you if you'd like to get in on this conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're talking with Alan Bernstein, who is one of the co-authors of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work, wondering what you think this morning. You know, we don't all necessarily have the liberty. Maybe it's because we don't give ourselves the liberty, but we don't necessarily all have the liberty to do what Susan did. Sometimes we have responsibilities that kind of force us to stay in situations that aren't necessarily healthy for us. There's a balancing act there, isn't there?
Absolutely, there is. We don't lightly suggest that people quit, but what we suggest is that they give themselves the opportunity to measure what it would be like to disengage from a goal that is not making them happy.
Okay.
And then to re-engage with a new goal and, you know, of the steps that we talked about, which is really taking it apart and looking closely at each piece and measuring how close the life you're leading comes life that you want to lead. I mean, obviously, in Susan's case, it didn't come very close at all. So she had a kind of imperative internally to leave and to make it.
All right, we're going to take a break for news, and when we come back, I want to talk some more about that, how we make those decisions and how we do it right, because that's the important part. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. We're going to quit this program for just a few minutes, and then we'll come back and pick it up again. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. That's the book under discussion this hour on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday. We have Alan Bernstein with us, one of the co-authors of this book, and we've been discussing what it means, what we're talking about when we talk about the art of quitting. Quitting gets kind of a bad rap in our culture. It's considered a bad thing to do. Persistence is a value, and we're kind of acculturated to believe that, but sometimes we need to quit, to change direction in our life in order to achieve our real goals. Like to hear your stories. 800-642-1234. You feel like you're in a rut in your job or in a relationship, but you don't know how to take that first step toward making a change? What has stopped you from calling it quits in the past? What are your fears about quitting? Have you ever quit something, and how did that turn out? Or was it a mistake? If you've taken the leap to quit something, what advice do you have for people on the fence about making a major change in their life? What role, Alan Bernstein, do optimism and persistence still play in this discussion?
Well, persistence, as we've talked about, is a double-edged sword. In other words, culturally, people are told that persistence is the only way to go. And what we argue in the book is that persistence is one of a number of choices. We don't recommend that people quit in the slamming the door, walking out idea, but that they consider it as a possibility if they're, you know, unhappy in some phase of their life.
How important is happiness at the end of the day? I mean, is that a worthwhile goal in itself?
Well, I think that most people would argue that that being happy tends to make a fuller, richer life. I don't know that it's the only goal that we're searching for. I think satisfaction, meaning, may be more important than just a word like happiness. But I think the direction of our lives should be towards happiness, and that what we advocate is that people understand that persistence is supported by a number of unconscious ideas, like the ones we talked about earlier today, intermittent reinforcement, where people are fed just enough to keep themselves thinking that things might get better, you know, that Skinner rats idea that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
and the sunk cost fallacy. And people are very reluctant to acknowledge that they've, you know, put too much time, effort, and money into something, and at this point in their lives, it's too late for them to give it up and to go in a different direction. And we talk about, you know, the possibility of having to go through a process to reengage with something new. That for people, it involves deciding whether the goals they followed are extrinsic, in other words, dictated by external expectations, money, parents, place to live, spouse, or whether it's more internal and how important that is to them.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we you know, for us, the danger for people is to get stuck in what's called rumination, which is not a great place to be, where you sort of decided that things are good enough, but really not good enough. And people get stuck there because they can't tolerate the feeling of having lost so much of their lives and having made a mistake. And that's a tough spot to get out of. I mean, it requires you may need friends who are optimistic for you. And you asked about optimism, the place of optimism in this. Optimism is a strange force. They say in business what you're looking for if you want to start a new business is that you want a pessimist to start with. In other words, someone who can figure out what the options are and how likely it is that a business is going to be successful and do the math and do the historical assessment. And then you want an optimist to push it through once you commit yourself to the idea. So, you know, you have to be careful what they call the optimistic bias, which is a tendency to overestimate the likelihood of success in a new field.
I think we call that looking at life through rose-colored glasses.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And you want to be careful about that. You also can't commit yourself to the idea that you're only going to be happy going forward. One of the things that I've observed with people is that they may need time, even on a daily basis, to have what we call a pity party, where they just feel bad that they've, you know, wasted part of their lives. I mean, as I mentioned to you earlier, I made an error when I first started out, in the sense that I wanted to be an academic and spent a number of years working towards a PhD, only to find that it really was a dead end for me. And there was a part of me that felt very, very sorry for myself that I'd made this error. And then I was able to create enough of a sense of where I was going and how important that was that it pulled me through. But don't imagine you're going to escape, you know, bad feelings about having made a mistake. You're not.
Let's try and get a couple of calls in here. Tom in Burlington, we'll go to you first. Whoops. Actually, we'll go to Kim in Iron River. Kim, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. And I can definitely relate to having the pity party for myself when I was in different jobs down in Madison, and I felt I was in the, you know, the central of the world, as Madison seems to be sometimes, working with the Wisconsin DNR and the Wisconsin State Cartographer, really enjoying my jobs. But I was 5 to 6 hours south of my fiance, and so I've been applying to different jobs, and you know, that's really hard to tell your employer that you're looking for different jobs despite enjoying your current jobs. So I was able to get a new job, getting a little less money. But right now where I'm in my life, I'm married with a new house and a baby on the way, and I couldn't be more happy. It's just really, I feel like I am in the exact place I want to be in my life.
Well, Iron River is a great place to be.
Central snowmobiling and ATV trails.
And the Blueberry Festival every July.
Yes, yes. I still haven't found where all the blueberries are, but they have some wonderful blueberry popcorn, apparently.
Yeah, they're great. And you got Bee's Busy Bakery there, too. Good donuts. Okay, let's go to Tom in Burlington. Then we're going to take a break, and then Alan Bernstein wants you to respond to our callers. Tom in Burlington, good morning.
There's a line in Casablanca where Claude Rains says to the Nazi general, he said, "A wise tactical retreat, general." And I guess everybody has to make a wise tactical retreat. Maybe if General Lee had made the tactical retreat in the battle over there with Pickett's charge, maybe things would have been different there. It, also in Wall Street, they have an automatic thing. If you buy a stock while you're still thinking clearly, you put a stop loss underneath that stock, and if it goes to that price, then you're automatically out of it, and you don't have to make the mental torture of buying or selling. But I wanted to ask this question. This, the idea of the intrinsic motivation, does that come from this place? I've noticed with the religion, if they tie something with religion, it has a much more powerful thing to it than anything else. And I wonder if intrinsic motivation comes from that. In other words, with these with the bombers, the suicide bombers or something, and things in the Bible, they connect that with religion, and it has such power. So there's some place in people's psyche that has this intrinsic motivation, or do they come from the same place in our psyche?
Tom, thanks for the call. We'll have Alan Bernstein respond to that in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more of our discussion about Mastering the Art of Quitting with Alan Bernstein, co-author of that book. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. It's a new book written by Peg Streep and Alan Bernstein. We have Alan Bernstein with us. We're talking about this book and about the art of quitting today. And Alan Bernstein, we had a couple of callers before the break. Why don't we start with Tom's question? He wants to hear more about intrinsic motivation.
Well, it was an interesting question because if you feel that spiritually you're called in a certain direction, it can be a very powerful intrinsic force. But he also hinted that it can be a force that works for evil. In other words, if people imagine that they're being called upon by some higher force to murder or to kill, that the spiritual force then becomes not a force for individual realization, but a force for mass destruction. And it's a very interesting point that he raises. How do you know the difference between them? So the quitting that we're advocating is not the kind where you become a mass murderer, but more the kind where you realize what your individual motivation is. In other words, the engine that drives your sense of yourself. How do you realize yourself? And unfortunately, school doesn't necessarily prepare us for that. I was taking my PhD in literature because I love to read, but actually loving to read has very little to do with the business of being an academic. So, we may have to do some work in our adult lives to come closer to what we would call at this point a productive, intrinsic sense of ourselves.
And then We heard from Karen in Iron River about a big career change that she made, and it really worked great for her.
Yeah, that was a lovely story. Karen realized that the highest value for her was being a wife and mother, and that the reduction in the extrinsics, in other words, salary and her position in Madison was secondary to her really experienced desire to be a wife and mother, which she has realized, and sounds like she's as happy as can be about it. So, I mean, that was in her case, it was such a good example of having to weigh and measure what it's like to put quitting on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Many people won't put quitting on the table because they can't stand the feeling that they may be seen as losing something.
Here's an email from Kathy that I think is quite interesting. Kathy emails, I know people who retire from their careers who fall into depression or just go into a decline, while others seem to thrive. It's like some see themselves as quitting their careers with no life ahead of them. Any advice for retirees other than you can finally clean out the garage?
Well, the last book I wrote was called Your Retirement Your Way. That was a few years ago when people actually retired. And absolutely, her point is very well taken. Retirement is an opportunity to remake your life. And there are people whose sense of themselves has been so dependent on their career. It's so unilaterally guided that when they give up the title of career, they simply have no sense of who they are as people. Whereas other people have a more harmonious life where there are, you know, many goals in life, and they seem to thrive more easily. They float into a new life.
Is that gender-based at all? I mean, anytime you get several men together and they introduce each themselves, they identify, you know, I'm John Munson, I work in radio. I mean, work is part of the personal identity. That doesn't seem to be quite as true in my experience for women. So, I mean, is there a gender thing? And also, is this also, we had another emailer who asked if there were generational differences in terms of how we look at stuff like this.
Well, let's talk about the first. I think the issue is how closely any person, male or female, identifies with one part of their life. In other words, for a man, it may be career. For a woman, it may be motherhood. And the issue isn't so much whether men are more likely or more prone to a kind of unidimensional version of themselves and then, you know, become depressed about it when they lose it any more than women whose whole life has been wife and mother, and then children leave the nest and they have no definition of themselves. But the question is creating multiple goals in your life so that you basically harmonize your life. In terms of generation, I mean, what I've observed is that people in what we call the boomer generation, by and large, have stayed longer at their careers. They thought of their career as a ladder on which they were climbing slowly up, whereas people in the millennial generation, younger generations, tend to see their lives more as a kind of spider web, where they are moving right and left and acquiring skills which will enable them to move in the direction of their lives they want, but not necessarily in the same company or the same corporation or the same profession. So that's an observation that I've made and other people have made, that there's a different mindset about loyalty and staying in one place and developing connections.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Don in Wausau next. Don, good morning.
Good morning. Am I talking on the air?
Yes, you're on the air. Don, go ahead.
Okay. I was married for 41 years. I'm 63 years old, and wife left, and I'm just having a hard time letting go. It's hard to say goodbye to somebody after you know them for that long.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes it hard is she's final, and I'm fighting. And it's kind of hard when you can't stop fighting.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. You know, I mean, I don't want to oversimplify your situation, but right now you're in the position of feeling like it wasn't your choice. You weren't really consulted on this, and that really does suck. I mean, there's no question about it, and I suspect that when you reconsolidate and accept the finality of it, then your job is going to be to develop new goals for yourself, but it doesn't sound like you're near there right now.
Well, and Don's got kind of a double whammy. He just retired, and his marriage is ending, so there's kind of two strikes there.
I mean, you may want to consider, you know, talking closely with one of your friends, or even, you know, consider talking to a therapist at this point about, you know, how stuck you feel. Because the longer you stay stuck in that ruminative position, the more, you know, unlikely it becomes that you start thinking of yourself as having a creative opportunity right now that probably sounds like it's a million miles away from you. But believe it or not, you probably will go in that direction.
We're getting close to the end of the program. Thanks, Don, for sharing your story with us this morning. We're getting close to the end of the program. You have some examples in the book of what you call unsuccessful quitting. I want to just briefly talk about those, but then I want to kind of summarize, you know, how do we quit well? But talk about some unsuccessful examples of quitting.
Well, I worked with a really interesting, smart guy a few years ago, and he stayed with me as a good example of poor quitting. You know, usually the process when you leave one career and go to another, and he really didn't. He was a lawyer, didn't want to be a lawyer anymore, wanted to go to the business side. And usually I encourage people to start the process of networking, which is basically talking to people in other careers, doing some preliminary work. And usually what happens, you talk to friends and they move you on to other friends that are closer to where you're trying to go. But that wasn't happening for him. And he was a smart guy with an MBA and as well as a law degree, but he wasn't moving anywhere. So finally I asked him, tell me exactly what you're saying in the conversation. He says, well, I tell people what a mistake I made going to law school and how what a lousy profession it was. And I realized that he was basically telling everybody what a loser he was and how his career was one big error. And I said to him, look, people want to help you move on if you know where you're going. In other words, if you can convert yourself into a resource going forward, you're going to do fine. But if you imagine that the people you talk to are going to be trying to console you and making you feel better, they're not going to move you. They're not going to help you get into a new position. He was what we call leaking his sadness and looking for people to console him. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not a way forward. You can't imagine for yourself that people are going to both feel sorry for you and try to move you into a position where you're going to be in a new career.
We've got about a minute left. What is the most important thing for us to consider if we want to quit well?
Aside from totally letting go in the way that we talked about, acknowledging the fact you made an error and going through the various ways in which you might be, framing yourself into not moving, the intermittent reinforcement that we talked about, you really have to set your goals very clearly. You have to make them very specific. You have to commit to the goals. And there must be no conflicting goals. In other words, like the wife we talked about who wanted her husband to change his spending habits, but she wanted to stay with him forever, and he was refusing. Then we find if you frame the goal in a question rather than an imperative, in other words, if you say, will I do this? And make it interesting, far more likely to be successful than if you say, I will. In other words, give yourself no movement right or left, but just imagine going straight forward.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Alan Bernstein, for an interesting hour. Appreciate it.
Very much.
The book is The Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. Cynthia Schuster produced this hour. Robin Cherry handled on-air production. Christy Taylor was our director. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardim. Don't quit listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.